Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and your moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, June 28th, 2026. The share ID numbers for Friday, June 26th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,583, that's 23583. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,584, that's 23584. This morning, A Vision for You presents Working with Others, Passing on the Miracle. Step 12 declares, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. The Big Book states, we have recovered and have been given the power to help others. Yes, it's really true. Under the compulsions of self-preservation, duty, and love, our society has concluded that it has but one high mission, and that high mission is to carry the OA message to those who don't know there is a way out. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded because Bill Wilson realized that he needed to work with another alcoholic in order to stay sober. That other alcoholic, of course, was Dr. Bob. The realization led him to a meeting with Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio in 1935 and to AA's co-founding. The need to work with other alcoholics is basic to the AA program and the reason that the fellowship was born and co-founded. This need to work with others is basic to our 12-step program of Overeaters Anonymous and all 12-step programs that have emanated from AA. We must carry this message of recovery, otherwise we ourselves may fall into decay, and those who have not yet been given the truth may die. The Big Book spends a substantial portion of Chapter 7 on how to work with other alcoholics, particularly those who are brand new to recovery. The suggestions it offers are based on the experience of Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, and other AA pioneers. This chapter is still the most authoritative work on how to 12-step someone. Times have changed, that's true, in the last 80-plus years, but the basic principles about passing on the miracle have not. Joining us today to elaborate on working with others is Janet B., a recovered compulsive overeater from North Carolina. Janet is dedicated to our 12-step way of life. She's a loyal servant to OA and to A Vision for You and is devoted to carrying the message of recovery. And it's with great pleasure and appreciation I welcome Janet B. to the line this morning. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Leah. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me here. I'm excited to be here to talk about this chapter. So I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. So I am going to just, obviously, I don't have time to go deep, deep, deep into this chapter. So this is more like a survey, like the high. Start on page 89, where it says, practical experience shows nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking, from binging, as intensive work with others. It works when other activities fail. Carry this message to other alcoholics, for other compulsive eaters. So right off the bat, it tells me I can have immunity. When I think of immunity, I think of like COVID, when people were out getting the vaccines so that they just didn't have to, so that they were immune, so that they were protected, right? And that's what this program gives me. If I go through the steps and carry this message, I am protected. The illness can't touch me. And it says carry this message. So when I was preparing this, I was thinking back to my early days in Overeaters Anonymous. I spent my first 7 years in OA not getting better. In fact, getting progressively worse. And I was thinking about the lovely women who tried to carry a message to me. I had, no joke, about 50 sponsors in those 7 years. And I could never get, I think my record was 2 weeks of abstinence because other messages were carried to me. Messages like, great, you say you're powerless, here's a food plan, stick to it. That's not our message. I remember my first sponsor when I ate compulsively, because of course that's what I would do. It wasn't bad enough where she told me, oh, it's not good that you did that. She called her sponsor to kind of beat me up also. That's not this message. And then I was thinking about my second sponsor, again, a lovely woman. And she said, whenever you want to eat, just picture me sitting on your shoulder telling you not to eat. Very sweet, but that's not this message. Can you imagine someone with cancer picturing someone on their shoulder telling them, remember, tell your cancer cells not to multiply. That's not this message. So they're really clear. I have to carry this message. I have an obligation to do it as best I can. Obviously, I'm never going to do it perfectly, but I need to do my best. And then they give us a promise. Life will take on new meaning. We'll see others recover. We'll watch loneliness vanish. A fellowship grow up around us. They say, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. And I remember thinking, how do they know what I'm going to want? How do they know I'm not going to want to miss it, that they know that? Because they know, the founders of this book knew that if I work this program, if we work this program, our hearts would be changed so that we wouldn't, that I wouldn't be thinking all day about myself, my wants. What do I want to do for myself? I will really care about others. And frequent contact with y'all is the bright spot of my life. And it really is true. Thankfully, after 7 years in Overeaters Anonymous, I was at an OA convention. I was actually eating compulsively at the convention. And a woman stood up and she held up a big book and said she hadn't binged in a year. To me, a year was like eternity. Remember, I often couldn't even make it to work without binging on the way. And after she was done, I just went up to her and I just said, can you help me? And she said that she worked the program the way it's worked in this big book. She asked me to read it. I spent the Saturday night of the convention in my hotel room reading this. Next day I found her and she said, are you willing to do everything in this book? And I said, no, because there's this one amend I was not willing to make. And she just very wisely said, are you willing to believe that by the time you get to your ninth step, you'll be a different person? And I said, okay. And that started a journey to recovery. She carried this message. And they tell us still on page 89, don't start out as an evangelist or reformer. It's just, I can be uniquely helpful because I've had this experience. It's not my job to kind of keep track, like I got 38 people through the steps. It's not my job to reform OA or to reform any person. It's simply my job to do God's will. And God's will for me is to try to carry this message. So page 90, they start giving us instructions, and there's instructions, a few pages of what we do before we even sponsor someone. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, his religious leanings. I always have an initial talk. Back when we were all meeting in person, and our sponsees were all local, I would call it like the Starbucks conversation. I would meet someone at Starbucks. We would talk. I would get to know them. They would get to know me because people don't like to feel like projects, right? Like, okay, I've met you. Good. I can sponsor you. Here's a food plan. You know, take two food plans and call me in the morning and, blah, you know, like a robot. people need to feel cared about. So I want the person to feel that I care about them. Oh, do you have kids? Tell me about your kids. Tell me about your hobbies. You know, things like that. And importantly, it says at the top of page 90, if he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. Now, a lot of times I'll meet people and, you know, they're in the food and they say, I guess I don't want to stop. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Why are you here? They say, well, I must not want to stop because I'm still in the food. And I say, no, no, no. There's a difference between not wanting to stop and not being able to stop. I said, so if you had a fairy godmother who would come and wave her magic wand and remove your food obsession, would you tell her to do it? And almost always they say yes. Believe it or not, twice, two people have said to me, no, I wouldn't want her to. For that person, I can do nothing. And I'm not supposed to, right? It tells me, don't waste time trying to persuade him. But for the person who says, yes, I would want this food obsession removed, but I must not want it badly enough, help. Because remember, our book tells us back in the chapter, there is a solution. Let me find the page. I think it's 20. Hold on. 24. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. So just because a person is in the food doesn't mean he or she doesn't want to stop. If someone can have the desire, not have the power, right? That's what the chapter We Agnostics is all about. We lack. So it says, here I am. I get to know the person and, you know, and then at the bottom of page 90, it says, you might place this book where he can see it in the interval. Don't be over anxious. And page 91, they're very clear. Don't give false hope. He may be more receptive when depressed. I recall going to OA meetings and people saying, don't worry, it'll get better. Well, it didn't get better. It got progressively worse. I started binging and purging because I just didn't want to gain any more weight. And after 7 years in OA, I was binging and purging up to 6 times a day. Just keep coming, it'll get better is false hope. Now, of course, a person should keep coming because they're likely to hear information. But sitting in a meeting alone does nothing, right? Imagine if I go to a Diabetics Anonymous meeting and I'm really happy that now here's a fellowship and I'm not the only diabetic on the planet and other people have issues like me. I'm going to feel great. But if nobody tells me about the medication it takes to get better, or if they tell me about it, but I don't take it, I'm not going to get one bit better. So sitting in a Diabetics Anonymous meeting by itself would do nothing, and sitting in OA meetings by itself did nothing. They say, we do more when, you know, we talk about the hopelessness and then we tell the person our stories. I'm on page 91. If he's in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor, food has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture, right? Remember, we are friends. Friends don't moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories. Get him to tell some of his. So I have lots of things I can tell. If they want a humorous story, I'll talk about the time a friend and I were guests for a weekend at someone's house. And while the host and hostess were taking a nap, we polished off the entire chocolate cake in the refrigerator, cleaned it all up real good. And afterwards, I guess at dinner when the hostess was saying, gosh, I could have sworn I baked a chocolate cake. We just sat there with innocent face. Poor woman must have thought about stealing food, about stealing people's money for food, about eating a roommate's food and getting a replacement and eating the replacement before I could get it back, about how my bulimia was so severe I needed major surgery to repair my esophagus. I've got stories and I want to hear their stories. And they say, when he sees you know all about the game, then you describe yourself as an alcoholic, a compulsive eater. Page 92. Tell him how baffled you were. Give him an account of the struggles you made to stop. And then the important thing, show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. The mental twist. Why, even though I desperately wanted to stop binging, why couldn't I even make it to work without binging? And here's how I understand it. And they talk about this masterfully on page 24, that normally my memory is a defense against doing harmful. So I have a horrible cat allergy. So if I'm near a cat, I'm liable to have an asthma attack. So if someone invites me to her house, I ask, do you have a cat? And if she says yes, immediately my memory will grab the data points in my brain. You went near a cat, you had an asthma attack. You were near a cat, you had a sinus infection. You went near a cat, you were sick for 3 days. Generates a thought that runs across the bridge to my conscious mind where I make my decisions to say, stop, danger, cats will get you sick. And then I don't do it. Or another example, I grew up in Miami, Florida, and like all teenagers, just, you know, wanted to be out in the sun all the time. And I got some pretty nasty sunburns. So now if I'm about to go to the beach and it's like, do I really have to put on sunscreen? My memory will scan the data points. You went to the beach without sunscreen. You got a horrible burn on your face and you were miserable. You went to the beach without sunscreen. You got sick from so much sun. Generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind. Danger. Going to the beach without sunscreen will result in a disaster. And I put my sunscreen on. Well, let's talk about food. The best example I could think of was back in my college days, I would binge on these certain kind of cookies. It would come in a box of 20, I think. And I would tell myself, I'm just going to have one or two. Well, we know how that story ended. Yeah, I'd have one or two boxes. I would never be able to stop. It happened over and over. So here I go again, about to go down to the street to the drugstore to buy my box of cookies. And in my brain, my memory scans the data points. You said you were going to have one cookie, you ate a whole box. You said you were going to just have two cookies, you ate a whole box, you threw up, you couldn't go to class the next day, you were miserable. You said you were going to have one or two, you didn't stop, you couldn't stop. Generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind. Danger. You will not be able to stop after one or two. Don't do it. Except unlike with cats and sunscreen, the bridge was broken and the thought couldn't get across. I had no mental defense against that first compulsive bite. I couldn't remember strongly enough to deter myself. I couldn't keep the memory green. I couldn't just remind myself of all my horrible binge hangovers. Couldn't do it. There was a broken bridge. Mental twist. When it came to food, I thought differently than other people. And what I do with my sponsees is one of the earliest assignments I give them is I say, okay, go through and give me a couple examples of how your bridge works. Like I talked about cats and sunscreen. Then give me three very specific examples with food of how your bridge doesn't work. And by the way, another way our mental twist, our broken bridge works is I'll binge tonight and I'll be able to start tomorrow. We forget that we won't be able to start tomorrow. Or I'll binge tonight because I don't really care. We forget how much we really care. So again, we don't have a mental defense. This program teaches us how to make a different kind of defense, a spiritual defense. They continue on page 92, and again, they say, dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Continue to speak of alcoholism or compulsive eating as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. I think it's interesting the way they put it, that the conditions of the body and mind are accompaniments, like side issues, to the main problem, which is a spiritual illness, which requires a spiritual solution. Right back in chapter 5, it says, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of this illness. Very interesting. Those are the roots. But if we think of a tree, we don't see the roots of a tree. We just see the fruit. And the fruits of this illness, which can be seen by most, are resentments, fears, and harms to other people. They tell us, you know, they're telling us now, there are conditions of body and mind, but those are the accompaniments. And on page 93, they say, stress the spiritual feature freely. And, you know, I remember back on page 45, they tell us, you know, that many a times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritually matters, especially when we mention God. So what do, right? The person, it says we stress it freely. And it's, they say, okay, but even if the person's an agnostic or atheist, just make it clear the person doesn't have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose whatever conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. And, you know, there's some concepts people have that don't make sense, like a doorknob doesn't make sense. Or there's this saying I heard, you can make anything your higher power as long as it's not you. Well, that doesn't make sense. I mean, come on, anything? Can I make my coffee cup my higher power? My coffee cup maybe can give me energy, but it certainly can't restore me to sanity. And sometimes people say, well, make the group your higher power. Well, at the end of More About Alcoholism on page 43, it says, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide a defense. So the group can't be my higher power. What do? Well, it tells us, you know, the person just has to be willing to believe in a power greater than himself. And when they say power with a capital P, they're talking about God as the person understands God, willing to believe. That's all that's required to make my beginning and live by spiritual principles. Okay, how can someone practice being willing to believe? And I think our book tells us a lot we can do. So back on page 45, they talk about the honest doubts and prejudices we have. And they say, for instance, here's one, there's six in that paragraph. The word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. So a person might have a prejudice because they were brought up to think of God a certain way, and that way is incorrect or doesn't work for them. So again, we have the people work through their prejudices when they're on step two. Also, what I find useful is one of the earliest descriptions of God in the big book, again on page 45, where they tell us lack of power is our dilemma. So our solution is to find a power greater than ourselves. They say, obviously. And they say, but that's what this book is about. That's the mission statement of this book. And that's a job of a sponsor. Its main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. I point people to that line and I say, what does that one sentence tell us about God? If this power is going to solve my problem, this power must be able to think, right? I mean, I grew up in Miami, the land of hurricanes. A hurricane is a power greater than I am. But a hurricane can't think and solve my problem. This power has to be smart if it can figure out how to solve my problem. This power also has to be strong because it's like I have one unit of power and this illness has like 100 units of power. So this power, this God must, you know, needs to have at least 101 units of power. And finally, if this power, this God is going to solve my problem, this power must care about me. Well, that's the power, that's the God that maybe I can be interested, a God who cares about me, who cares about my problems. And then I suggest a prayer, and like the maybe prayer that can go something like this. God, I don't know if you exist, and if you do exist, I don't know if you care about me. But if you do exist and you do care, I need some help. personally think a prayer like that is irresistible to God. But there's a part B, right? That he lived by spiritual principles. Right back in page 14, it says, faith without works is dead, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive any of the trials and low spots ahead. So again, from day one, I tell my sponsees every day, at least one act of self-sacrifice. And by definition, self-sacrifice means I'm doing something to help someone else where I have to sacrifice something. My time, my sleep, my watching of Netflix. I give up something in order to help someone else. And they say, that's what I need. I have to be willing to believe. So at this part, a person doesn't have to believe. They just have to be willing. And they have to start living by spiritual principles. I had a friend in AA, and he said, from day one, an alcoholic can stop lying and stop stealing, right? We can do that by willpower. Stop stealing and start being honest. Because as we know, first paragraph and how it works, this program requires rigorous honesty. And so often when people are baffled and they say, I keep picking up and I don't know why, I find the answer is they're not being honest. And again, in my first 7 years, none of those 50 women sat down with me and said, if you're not honest, don't even bother because this program won't work. This program demands rigorous honesty. And they say, okay, so you may have someone who doesn't believe in God, but as long as they're willing, it's okay. But you may have someone who's like really religious and is wondering why this doesn't work. And then I love what it says in the AA 12 and 12, in step 7 on page 72. It says, we could actually have earnest religious beliefs which remain barren, like dead, because we were still trying to play God ourselves. So that tells me that, you know, if I'm trying to get everyone to do what I want and make the world happen the way I want it to, I'm playing God and my faith, my belief in God is dead, right? Bottom of page 93, they hit that home again. To be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. I could have faith that insulin works, but if I'm a diabetic who needs insulin, I need to be injecting it. So we need to have a faith that works. And page 94, they say, it's important for the person to realize that your attempt to pass this on plays a vital part in your own recovery. Again, people don't like to feel like projects. It tells us, suggest to the prospect how important it is he places the welfare of others ahead of his own, and says, make it clear he's not under pressure to see you and you won't be offended. So we should never be, I spent all this time with you, like, how dare you choose to pick someone else as your sponsor? If I talk to someone, I spend a lot of time and they pick someone else, great, you know, it's fine. Like, it's all good. And they say, you should not be offended if he wants to call it off. If I am offended, it just shows me how much pride I have. For he has helped you more than you have helped him. And I had a pretty dramatic experience with that once. My husband just like pretty much suddenly lost his job. And we were going on a cruise. It was already paid for. And so I'm on the cruise and I'm, you know, worried about money. And I'm like, okay, they have these Friends of Bill W. meetings on cruises. I'm going to go to the meeting and find, like, you know, hopefully this some very wise recovered alcoholic who can help me. And I went to the Friends of Bill W. meeting, and there was just one woman there. And she was overweight, and I told her that I was in OA, and she said she was also. And I said, how are you doing? And she said, well, look at me. How do you think? I started sponsoring her on that cruise. We would get together and we would, you know, read the big book. And toward the end of it, I said, you know what? I was just looking for someone to help me. And she said, and you know what's interesting? I was looking for someone to help. And we both got what we wanted, but neither of us got it in the way we thought. Okay, page 94, bottom paragraph, it says, your candidate, again, we're not sponsoring the person yet, may give reasons why he need not follow all of the program. He may rebel at the thought of like a drastic house cleaning, discussing it with other people. It's okay for people to ask questions, and they can rebel at the thought at this point, but not when I sponsor them. So I will just tell you what I do. Again, there are many ways to do it. This is just a way to do it. I first have a general conversation with them. Then I ask them to go back and endure a podcast of mine called The Broken Bridge, where it's actually called Building a Bridge to God, where I explain in detail the concept of the broken bridge. And I say, write down three highlights, come back to me, and we'll discuss it. So if they do that, come back, we discuss it, and then it's like, great. Now do some work on the doctor's opinion, and then they come back and we discuss it. I go through what I think are the important points of the doctor's opinion. So by now we've had three conversations. They've done two assignments, because remember, in the chapter, it's actually in two employers on page 142, it says, we believe a man should be thoroughly probed, right? I want to make sure this person means business. And at that point, I say, okay, here are the things I ask my sponsees to do, right? Like one of them is do an act of self-sacrifice every day. One of them is, you know, practice rigorous honesty and a few other things. And then I say, go back and think about it. Even if you say you want to move ahead, take the night and think about it. So we've had three conversations. I asked them to, you know, take time and think about it. And at this point, if they come back and say, yes, I agree to do it all, they can always ask me questions, but they can't rebel, because they can't say, no, I'm not doing it. Because remember, page 58 tells us, if you have decided you want what we have, and what do we have? We have one thing, a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's the only thing I have to offer. And are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. So, you know, my requirements are really a person wants this. They want this spiritual awakening, and they're willing to do whatever it takes. Then they're ready to take certain steps. And by the way, if they're not, and if later they're like not doing it, I don't say to them, I think you need another voice, because there's like nothing wrong with my voice. If they're not doing it, there's a problem with they're not willing to go to any length. And so I just point to that paragraph in page 58 and say, I'm not allowed to sponsor you, because I'm only allowed to sponsor people who are willing to go to any length. Okay, page 95, again, they say, give him a chance to think it over. And if he wants this, don't talk down from any moral or spiritual hilltop. I'm not one bit better than anyone else. I just am someone who maybe got on the bus a couple of stops before the next person. That's it. It says simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. Show him how they worked with you. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him if he wants to get well, you'll do anything to help. So if I'm going to do anything to help, right, it tells me it's going to be work for me. But I'm supposed to offer friendship and fellowship no matter what. That means people are always welcome at meetings. That means, you know, we're still friendly. We don't cut people out. And they say, if he's not interested, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. So again, the way I read this and the way I understand this is if someone picks up and they're not doing the work, then, and I always give another chance, right? Of course. But if they say, you know what, I'm just not willing to do this, then I have no choice but to drop them. But I don't drop someone just because they pick up. I mean, look what the book says at the beginning. I think it's forward to the second edition. is that 25% of the people got sober after some relapse, like a quarter of us. So yeah, of course, relapse is not supposed to be part of our recovery. And it says, as it says on page 120, it's infinitely better that we have no relapse at all. But, you know, sometimes it happens. And if a person is willing to go to any length, then we can keep working with them. And they tell us, okay, we asked this person to read this book. Now, they were dealing with people, when they're talking about this, who weren't familiar at all with this program. If there's someone who's brand new to OA, I might ask them to read this book, to read the first 164 pages. That's what was asked of me. And they say a person shouldn't be pushed or prodded. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. Not if he's to stop binging, the desire must come from within. If he's to find God, because that is the solution to our problem. And they tell us, if he thinks he can do it some other way or prefers another spiritual approach, we say, that's fine, follow your conscience. We have no monopoly on God. I have no monopoly on God. I should never say, this is the only way. Now, I can say, this is the way that worked for me. It's the only way that I know how to do it. But I'm not going to say, this is the only way, because what do I know? Page 96, they tell us, don't be discouraged if the person doesn't respond. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. And that's who we want to sponsor, someone who is desperate and eager. Now, eager doesn't mean they have this like great desire to do this hard thing, right? It says at some of these we balked, but who's just going to do it without fighting back. I'm thinking of the women who I'm sponsoring now who are through the steps, and I would say almost without exception, they just basically had the attitude, I'm lit, I'll do whatever you say, and they got better. Now, of course, then it's my obligation to make sure I don't tell them to do anything that contradicts what's in this book. But of course, you know, things like having a food plan aren't in this book. But to me, these are things that are helpful, so I will recommend things that I believe are helpful. So 96, they're still talking about someone, by the way, who you're not sponsoring yet. Suppose now you're making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume and says he is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. These are the people we want to sponsor, right? It tells us how much work we have to do. Age 97, don't avoid responsibilities. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. My husband's a builder. I should have asked him in advance what a foundation stone is, but I'm assuming it's a stone on which you build something. The stone here on which we build our recoveries is helping others. And how much help? Well, they say a kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the good Samaritan every day if need be. So they talk about what sacrificed our sleep. We may have some rough times. I mean, look, a drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress. I mean, I don't think we have to deal with anything near like that. But how much do I complain if someone calls while I'm watching American Idol, right? Basically, they say your life shouldn't be as easy peasy and you get to do everything you want the way it was before. For me, it means I may not get to watch as much Netflix. I may not to have as much fun activities. It says occasionally we will have to meet these conditions. And at the bottom of the page, they talk about the family. We don't often get involved with families, but I think there's a tidbit here that's helpful to all of us. Says, should the family accept and practice spiritual principles, there's a much better chance the head of the family will recover. And even though he continues to drink, the family will find life more bearable. So I find just for myself, there's a couple of cool spiritual principles here. They say if I'm practicing spiritual principles, I'll be able to bear more. That means the things that bothered me so much won't bother me as much. And that means if I act humbly and practice spiritual principles, it'll set a good tone for the rest of my family. What are some spiritual principles I can practice? Of course, self-sacrifice, about letting things go, not having to make a big deal out of everything, keeping my mouth shut and not telling other people what they need to do. On page 98, they say, if someone's going to get well, little charity in the ordinary sense of the word is needed and wanted. It's not the matter of giving in question, but when and how to give. That we should never make it that the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. Inevitably, if I call my sponsor with a problem, she will say to me, did you go to God first? God should be first. They say, yeah, we don't want to sponsor the kind of people, or we want to make sure that our sponsees aren't claiming that they can't get over compulsive eating until our material needs, or I think our emotional needs, are cared for. They say, it's really hard to learn this. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking, stop binging, so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. Well, how do I do that? How do I place my dependence on God first? I think first thing I have to do is look at how I'm depending on other people, or I might say codepending on other people. Do I have idolatry with other people? Do I think I can't get well as long as dot, 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 as long as, you know, my husband isn't treating me right, as long as my kids aren't doing well? There's some saying I heard, a mother is only as happy as her least happy child. And when I heard that, I say, I reject that. I am not going to make my happiness dependent on the happiness of my children or how well my children are doing. That's idolatry, right? If I place my happiness on how well other people are doing, and then I depend on God. And all that means is I simply do what I think God wants me to without really worrying about the consequences too much. And then they tell me something, my job as a sponsor, burn the idea into the consciousness of everyone. He can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trusts in God and clean house. Well, those are some pretty hefty conditions, right? First, trust in God. What if a person doesn't trust in God? And I find this is, in my opinion, one of the most helpful things that we can do to help someone, is to go back to page 60, where I think it really talks about that. And we go through the ABCs with them. We ask our sponsee to look at that. A, that I am a compulsive eater and could not manage my own life. That's easy. You know, we wouldn't be here if we didn't believe that. Great. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsive eating. Okay, we can usually get that too. C, believes that God could and would if he were sought. So that's where we get to the trusting God issue. And that's where a lot of people say, no, no, I don't. Or they may say, yeah, but if you probe, they really don't. So I like to break it down when I'm working with someone. Do you believe that God exists? And if they say no, well, then we've got work to do back on step two. But often by this point, right, because as they start working this, they see, you know, gosh, I have a day without binging, and I have 2 days, and I have 3 days, and I'm not thinking about food all the time. Well, that's not me. That must be God. Okay. Do you believe that God exists? Yes. Do you believe that God has restored other people to sanity? Well, if a person's gone to a few meetings, they inevitably say yes. Do you believe that God could restore you personally to sanity if he wanted to? He may not want to, but could he if he wanted to? And here there's often a pause, but person thinks about it and says, okay, yeah, he's God. He could if he wanted to. And then here's the one where the trust issue comes in. Do you believe he will if you seek him? And this is where most people say, no, or I'm not sure. I'm like, great. Now we know where you are. We know where the sticking point is. And I have found there's generally five reasons why people don't trust that God will restore them to sanity. And then, of course, how can you surrender your will and your life to a God you don't trust? So here are the five reasons. One, I've done some really bad things. Two, not that I've done some bad things, but I'm just a bad person. I'm not worthy. Like, we have this shame. You know, one is guilt over something specific. Two is shame. Three is, I've tried this so many times before and it hasn't worked. Why would God do it now? Four is, well, I caused this illness, right, by my own selfishness and self-centeredness, so I have no right to go to God. And five is, I'm not willing to seek him. To the person who says number five, I say, you're right. No guarantee that God will restore you to sanity. But to the other four, there's answers. If someone says, I've done some really bad things, I would say, you are in great company. First, so did I. So did the founders of this program. That's why there's a ninth step here. We get a chance to fix the things we've done wrong. Number two, and I think this is what most people have, I'm just not worthy of it. And then I say, you know what? First, neither was I. And if you look through the big book, you will not find the word worthy anywhere in the text section. God does not require worthiness. He only requires willingness. God doesn't care if we're worthy or not. He only cares that we're willing. It doesn't matter that we feel we're not good enough. I certainly was not good enough. I did like insane things like fake muggings and a rape to get attention and cause people a lot of harm because they were worrying about me and taking care of me when nothing was wrong, okay? I certainly wasn't worthy. God doesn't care. Number three, I've tried it so many times before, and here I generally will pick up my cell phone and say, you know, I could try for 7 years to take pictures by pushing the on-off button, and it won't work. But if suddenly someone comes around, my son, and says, Mom, you're doing it wrong. Here's how to take pictures. And I'm willing to listen to him. It doesn't matter if it's my first day with a cell phone or I've been trying for 7 years or 30 years to take pictures. I can take pictures now. And the fourth is like, well, it's my fault. Either I caused this or I haven't worked these steps so long and it's my fault. I would say, well, let's say I'm looking at my cell phone, the same phone I can now take pictures on, and I'm crossing the street looking at that phone and I get hit by a truck. Would I ever say to the ambulance driver, don't take me to the hospital to get my two broken legs fixed? It's my fault. Because I was looking at my phone, just leave me here on the street. I would never do that, right? And neither would any of us, I'm sure. But when it comes to God, it's like we feel all this like false noble, like I'm not going to bother God. It's okay. We can bother God. So I help someone work through their fears that God isn't trustworthy. And then clean house, right? No, again, back on page 98, trust God, clean house, only conditions to get better. You know, step four, I look at my resentments, including and especially my part, my fears, my harm, craft a sex ideal. Step five, I share it with someone else and with God. Step six and seven, I get ready for God to remove them. To me, step seven, it blows me away. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. That means God's going to, like, they wouldn't put that step in if God was going to say no. It's like, oh, we'll make this step where we ask God to remove our shortcomings, but we know he's not going to. No, that makes no sense. You know, he's going to. He's going to start changing me. So I don't have to be have shame anymore or feel bad, because God is going to change me into the kind of person he wants me to be like. And then I have the fortitude to make my amends, steps 8 and 9. And then they start giving us clues on how we should live, right? It says, okay, there might be family problems. And though your family may be at fault, don't focus on that. Concentrate on your own spiritual demonstration. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague. So what I advise my sponsees is that until you're through the steps, if your spouse is doing something wrong, say nothing unless it's dangerous, like he's leaving the baby in the bathtub and walking away. Dangerous. Say nothing. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague. You know, we've all lived through a plague about 5 years ago. We know how strictly we avoided it. You know, a lot of people wore masks, and I think about, you know, how we covered our mouths then, and about a wonderful prayer that I heard. I actually heard it on a Friends of Bill meeting on a cruise from a long-timer in AA, how she kept her mouth closed against argument and fault finding. She called it the shut-up prayer. God, please keep one hand on my shoulder and another across my mouth. And they say, okay, this argument and fault finding, top of page 99, is hard, but it has to be done if any results are to be expected. So if I want to stop eating compulsively, one of the things I need to do is avoid argument and fault finding. And they say, if you persist in this for a few months, because this takes time, the effect on our families is sure to be great. What a beautiful promise. When my son was 17, we had a very difficult relationship. And then at one point I made up my mind that, yeah, no more argument and fault finding. So when he started saying stuff, I would say, you know, I'm sorry. And then he would say, no, you're good. And I'm sorry. And then it just started healing our relationship. As we talk about our stuff, then little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness, not telling each other what to do. And my husband and I have something now on Sunday nights. We'll sit down and we'll say, okay, is there anything I've done this week that's bothered you? And the other person will say it. And then the other one will say, okay, is there anything I've done? And then we talk about it in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. And it says, yeah, when the family sees this, they're going to want to go along. But no matter what they do, we, the person in recovery, have to be sober, considerate, and helpful, regardless of what anyone says or done. Remember, I am never the cause of anyone else's relapse, and no one else is the cause of mine. And they say, we all fall below the standard many times, but we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty by a spree. I want to say something about that. There's a few places in this book where it talks about if we do something or don't do something, we are going to pick up. Here's one. Another place is where it talks about amends. It says if we don't lose our fear of creditors, we're sure to drink again. On page 70, it says if we fall down on our sex ideal and we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. So as a sponsor, one thing that I don't do is automatically assume that if my sponsee has picked up, he's got to go back to step one. It's not always a step one problem. So for instance, if someone is on step 9 and she's refusing to make an amend, the absolute worst thing I could do is to say, you need to start over on step 1, either with, you know, with me or another person, because then they'll just keep doing the step 1 through 9 dance forever and ever. What I say is, you need to go make that amend. Pray for the willingness, and if it's called for, you need to go make that amend. someone once called me and said, I picked up, you know, my sponsor told me to call you. Can you sponsor me? And I talked to her for a while and said, what step were you on? And she said, 9. I said, were there any amends you weren't willing to make? And she said, yes, there were 2. I'm like, that's fine. We can talk about me sponsoring you, but you need to go make those 2 amends. And she did. Okay. Again, bottom of page 99, they say, let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. Remind the prospect. So again, this is my job as a sponsor. Remind the prospect, top of page 100, his recovery is not dependent upon people or circumstances. It is dependent upon his relationship with God, never on circumstances. And I love how they talk about this on page 68. They say, we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on us, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. So it's like a little formula. A units of surrender to God's will plus B units of trust equals AB units of serenity. How much calamity there is, what the circumstances are, don't come into play. And then they kind of shift gears and they say both you, so now they're not talking specifically about sponsoring, but also about how I have to live. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. Keep growing. How do I keep growing? 10, 11, and 12 every day. Clear away the wreckage of each day. Spend time in prayer, meditation, spiritual reading to get closer to God. Carry this message to others and try to practice spiritual principles in all I do. And then a beautiful promise. If you persist in this, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. But of course, right, if I were to make a list of my plans, it's limited by my imagination. But if I put myself in God's hands, well, God's imagination is unlimited. And then they give me a conditional promise. Follow the dictates of a higher power. Gosh, we usually wouldn't let that word dictate, but if I trust God, yeah, I'm okay doing anything he dictates. So if I follow the dictates of a higher power, then I will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what our present circumstances. So God will either overcome my bad circumstances or change my heart so that I'm okay living in it. And then bottom of 100, they start talking about if we're spiritually fit, we can do all things we're not supposed to do, right? We can go here, we can go there. We can meet these conditions every day, page 101. Now, a couple of caveats they make. They say an alcoholic who can't do it still has an alcoholic mind. There's something the matter with his spiritual status. Isn't that interesting? If I still have a compulsive eating mind, it means there's something wrong with my spiritual status, and I need to fix it on a spiritual basis. Now, yes, ultimately, we can go everywhere. Like, I don't even know where the candy aisle in my grocery store is. But when I was early on in recovery, I was careful. I remember there was a party at my work with food I couldn't eat. I just sat at my desk while other people were at the party and ate my meal. That's what I had to do at the time. You know, sometimes we have to know what we can or can't do. And they tell us on page 101, we always ask, do I have a legitimate reason for being wherever? And they say, of 102, if yes, go or stay away, whatever seems best. Be sure you're on solid spiritual ground before you start and that your motive is thoroughly good. And here's the good motive we're supposed to have. Don't think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. So what a good practice before we go anywhere to think, how can I contribute to it? But they tell us, if you are shaky, work with another alcoholic instead. Or if you're new and, you know, you can't sponsor someone else, find a way to be helpful instead. They say, what do? We try to increase the pleasure of those there. That is different than feeling responsible for someone's happiness. I can, like, give my daughter a gift because I want to give her pleasure. But if she opens it, it's like, which she has done, and says, yeah, this isn't really what I wanted. Well, that's okay. I'm not responsible for her happiness. I can give her the gift receipt and she can exchange it or sell it on eBay or whatever. What a great weight off my shoulders, realizing I am not responsible for anyone else's happiness. I can try and increase their pleasure. I can try and give joy. Proverbs 102, it says, what our job is now, to be at the place where we can be of maximum helpfulness to others. And then they talk about liquor. Remember, they were talking to alcoholics, and some of us still serve it to our friends who aren't alcoholics. Some of us don't have it in our house. We never argue this question. We feel each family ought to decide for themselves. And I think that's good for us to think with respect to things like food plans. Some people think certain foods no one should ever have. Some people are more liberal about it. I never get into debates about that. And by the way, I do not share my food plan with people generally other than like my sponsors and God, my nutritionist, because I, A, don't want people to judge me, and B, I don't want people to say, oh, if she does that, then maybe I can do that. Or if she doesn't do that, maybe I shouldn't do that. It's like, I don't drink diet soda, but if I have a sponsee who can drink diet soda, okay. So it says, you know, we don't argue things like that. And they say, we are careful. We don't show intolerance or hatred of drinking or, for us, sugar as an institution. I mean, it's like, I can't go near cats, but it doesn't mean that cats are inherently bad. They're just they're just a species I can't go around. They say, this isn't helpful when we do that. They say, we are not witch burners. And what are witch burners? People who say, if you're not like me, you're evil. We don't want to have a spirit of intolerance because that repels people. And they say, you know, we can't have bitterness or hostility. And they close by saying, our problems were of our own making, right? Chapter 5, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Puddles were only a symbol. Sometimes people say food blocks me from God, but that's not what the book says. They don't say alcohol blocks us from God. They say it's a symbol. Or back on page 64, they say it's a symptom. We have to face and be rid of the things in ourselves, our character defects, our self-reliance, which are blocking us. Our liquor, our food was but a symptom, but a symbol. And they close by basically saying we have to resign from the debating society. We have to. So I just want to sum up by saying, you know, step 12 says, having had a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message. And I was thinking, what is the heart of this message? And I go to what has become my favorite paragraph, page 25. The great fact is just this and nothing less. We should settle for nothing less ourselves, and our goal in helping our sponsees should be nothing less than this, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. What is a spiritual experience? Right? They point us to Appendix 2, which says it's a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism or compulsive eating. But here they describe it further, what this spiritual experience does. It revolutionizes our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator, what a beautiful name for God, our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. because at its essence, this program is about miracles. It is about our Creator entering into our hearts and lives in a way which is miraculous and commencing to accomplish for us, which we could never do by ourselves. And the way I think about it, what's the first thing I couldn't do by myself or for myself is remove my food obsession. God does that, and I believe that is just his opening ask. And with that, I will pass.
Thank you, Janet, for this very thorough, helpful, and instructive presentation this morning. Thank you so very much for all you gave to us. This morning's share ID, 23,588. That's 23588. Janet's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so please stay tuned for that. And we will transition now to question and answer segment. You can pose a question, questions only, one question per customer to Janet by pressing star one to unmute. And I need your name, including the first letter of your last name, please.
Joy at V, California.
Joy. Maureen H. I didn't catch your first name.
Maureen.
I'm sorry.
Maureen.
Okay, thank you.
H.
Thank you.
Maureen. Thank you.
Star one to unmute if you'd like to pose a question.
Rob H.
Rob H. All right, well, let's get started with these three. I have Joy MB, Maureen H., and Rob H. Joy, your question, please.
May I be heard?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. Thank you so much for your presentation. Honest, thorough, and wonderful, and thank you for hosting. You know, there's all this discussion about rushing people through the steps so they can sponsor because they'll get bored and blah, blah, blah. I'd like to know how long, or do you have a set time, do you take people through the steps? And do you ever incorporate the 12 by 12 or other books? Again, thank you.
Yes, the AA 12 and 12, I use especially for steps 6 and 7, because I think it's absolutely beautiful, and the big book just has two paragraphs on it. So especially for that. As far as how long it takes, it generally takes 1 to 2 months. And I know people do it faster and people do it slower. So again, you know, not looking to say anyone else is wrong. That's what I usually find. Again, it takes a few days till I even agree to sponsor the person. And what I do is I give them something to do, which is taking them through the steps. So I will read with them, let's say on, okay, now we're going to read chapters 2 and 3, which are on step 1. I'll give them something to do. So I mentioned like the broken bridge assignment. I'll give them another assignment on step 1. Then we talk about it. Then we work on step 2. I want to see what prejudices do you have against God? I want things like that. And then they go back and do the work. We talk about it. Step 3. I give them assignment like, if you were to turn your will and your life over to God, how would your life look different? Like very specific. And then they go back, and then the 4th step. So I'm always in contact, usually talk, depending on how quick they work, every day or every other day. And I would say 6 weeks or so is the average, 8 weeks, depending on how many amends someone has, but there's people who've done it. And then when they start sponsoring, I generally help them with the first couple sponsees because they'll have a lot of questions like, the person said this, what do I say? So I'll help them. And then after that, just what I do is I have a weekly meeting with all my sponsees so that we can stay in touch. So again, not saying it's the only way, but that's how I do it.
Thank you, Joy, for your question. Maureen H., your turn.
Hi, this is Maureen H., recovered in South Carolina. Janet, can you talk about forgiveness, please? I know about 8 and 9 is forgiving others, but I find a lot of my sponsees have trouble with forgiving themselves, including myself also. I'll pass. Thank you.
Yeah, so as far as forgiving myself, I know sometimes people say they put themselves on the resentment inventory. So it's like, I find that awkward. So if I say, I resent myself because I did whatever, it affects whatever, my part. Well, my part is I did the thing that I resent. I find it very awkward. What I find more helpful is to go to God and say, I did this wrong, and name the character defects, name the behavior that I'm feeling badly about or whatever. And our book tells us that if we go to God, right, we confess to God, ourselves, and another human being, we believe we will be forgiven. So I go through the process of, I see what I did wrong, I ask God to forgive me, I share it with another person, and then I believe I'm forgiven. My personal belief is if someone still can't do that, they either don't trust God, or it can be a pride thing, like, well, yeah, God may forgive me, but I know better than God, then I don't deserve forgiveness. As far as forgiveness for other people, two things. I found that almost always when me or someone else really sees our part, then we can forgive. So what I do is I try to help the person really see their part. I never tell them, oh, your part is this. I might make a suggestion. Well, it might be this. Does that ring true? If they say no, it's like, maybe it's that. No, does that ring true? And usually we can get it something like, yes, that's it. And then that helps us to forgive when we see our part. And if not, if I've really seen my part and it still doesn't go away, then there is, I believe it's in the chapter Freedom from Bondage, there's a prayer that we pray for someone every day for 2 weeks. And even if we don't mean it, we say it anyway. And I have found when I do that, God always, always softens my heart. Hope that helps.
Thank you, Maureen H. Rob H., your question, please.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I didn't really hear it this time, but I've heard you speak another time, and I was interested if you could speak a little bit more on this idea of when someone's ready to start working the steps, I've heard people say before, 3 days before they can start working the steps. I think I've heard you say before that it might be 2 hours or something. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that, or maybe I heard you wrong. So thanks.
Yeah, so I will tell you my experience. My experience was, I was binging and binging, and then one night I was binging right before a meeting. I was binging behind a locked bathroom door. And I went to a meeting, and at that meeting, I was so desperate, and I took a sponsor who I knew would let me get away with nothing. And I said, I will do anything you tell me to. And I went out into the parking lot, and I prayed, and it was like a hand reached into me and yanked out the obsession. And I've been abstinent since. I was not told to wait 2 days. And when I read the book, I don't see he didn't say, wait till you get 2 days sober, Bob. And so the way I read the book is No. And if I'm talking to someone and she says, I've just been binging, I say, well, are you binging right now? And if she says, no, like, we can start right now. And the 2 hours, I once did a Google search and I said, if someone is like all, I don't remember my exact terms, like fogged up with sugar and has just binged on sugar, how long until their head is clear and they'll be able to like understand what I'm talking about? And the answer was 2 hours. So that's where the 2 hours was from. But seriously, if I'm talking to someone and she said, I just finished binging and I'm desperate and I'm ready to do whatever it takes, I will start talking to her right then. No beef with anyone who does it differently. That's just my experience.
Thanks, Rob, for your question. Anyone else with questions this morning?
Wendy M.
Nancy L. Anyone else? Great opportunity.
Natalie M.
Okay. Wendy M., go ahead with your question, please.
Yeah, good morning. So, wow, what a talk. That was amazing, Janet. Thank you so much. I took copious notes. So here's my question. It's easy to work with someone who's just like, I'll do anything, let's go. But you said when they're in relapse, it's because they're not being honest about something. Like if they can put it down for a day or two and then they pick it up again, but they want to work with you. What's the process of getting them, quote, honest? And what does that look like? How do you help someone get to their honesty so that they're ready to work with you? Thank you so much.
Okay, I think you may have confused something I said. So this program requires honesty, and one of the causes of relapse is dishonesty. There's a bunch of causes, right? The book goes through, I went through the book once and I found, I don't know, a dozen or so different things that the book says cause relapse. Dishonesty is one of them. Honesty is something we can do on our own by willpower. My sponsor, who I got that night after, when I started my recovery, said to me that very night, you need to be honest. The first sign of dishonesty, we're done. So, boy, I made a decision right there that I was going to be honest. So it meant if I said something and I realized I was dishonest, I would stop myself mid-sentence and say, wait, what I just said, that wasn't true. And I would fix it until honesty became habitual. And now, truly, if I was dishonest, it would make me feel like I was going to throw up. I could not. I'm not dishonest. But that is something a person can do by willpower. If someone isn't willing to be honest, I won't sponsor her.
Thank you, Wendy M., for your question. Nancy L., your turn.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much, Janet. Such help this morning. Thank you. My question is, while you're taking someone through the 12 steps, do you take their daily food plan? And if so, do you continue to take it after you're finished with the 12 steps? Thank you.
I do take it. And once they're through the steps, I leave it up to them if they want to keep sending their food to me. Most of them do. But I leave it up to them at that point.
Thank you, Nancy L. Natalie M., your question, please.
Thank you for your service and for your share. It's fantastic. My question is about time management. I was wondering, you said you like to take people through the steps in like 6 to 8 weeks. If someone's working full time and maybe the sponsor is too, maybe it would take, 4 months because you'd be meeting once a week. for half an hour instead of being able to connect every single day. I'm wondering, have you seen, you know, successful levels of, you know, accomplishing the steps in, like you're doing with people who, you know, just are, how do you manage the time? How do you find the time to make it happen?
So, again, so the book says we spend much of our spare time in this work. So that means, you know, when we're not working at our jobs or taking care of our kids, or obviously we have to sleep and, you know, take care of ourselves, much of that leftover time spent doing this work. No, I have never seen someone who just works with a sponsee half an hour once a week that would be successful. In my opinion, that is not because I talk to someone who say it's any other day to work. I mean, I don't know, even I worked, I mean, now my kids are out of the house, but I worked this program when I was raising two kids, when I was working, and I always found time to sponsor, right? I mean, do it after work. Like, and it's, there's, I don't think that's enough once a week. I don't think that's giving much of my spare time. And if I will tell you this, I have a law degree. So I worked for a while in a law firm, and the job in the law firm was all consuming. It was just, it was insane hours, and it didn't last long. And then it's like, you know what? I'm not going to do this because I can't have the life I want to have that I think God wants me to have working these kinds of crazy hours. So I took a job working for the state, you know, like 8:30 to 4:30 job. Now, that's not saying that no one can work in a law firm, right? But for me, this way of life was really important. So I was willing to have like a job where I made less money, but had a lot less stress and a lot more free time. So that's my long way of saying, I don't think half an hour once a week is nearly enough.
Thank you, Natalie M., for the question. We still have time for one or two more questions. Anyone else like to pose a question this morning? I didn't catch that name. Lee H.
Ellen.
And Ellen, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Lee H., your question, please.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for hearing my name. This is Lee H. in Tennessee. Janet, that is just incredible what you shared with us today. This may just sound like a really simplistic, and you've probably already been over it, but just one main question. What do you do when you're tempted to pick up? Or, and what do you tell your sponsees to do when they're tempted to pick up? Thanks so much.
That's a great question. So thankfully, it rarely, very rarely happens. If it does, I right away would like one and do a 10 step because it means I've either got a resentment, fear, caused a harm, or there's something that I believe God wants me to do that I'm not willing to do. So that's exactly what I would tell my sponsees to do. First, make a call, you know, right away, and pray, you know, pray. And hopefully the person you call will pray with you. And then look to see where you're blocked. Right? Because in chapter 5, it says, resentments block us from the sunlight of the Spirit. And then the insanity returns and we drink again. So I need to quick find out what's blocking me so that I can get unblocked. So the other thing that might cause someone to be blocked is if they're through the steps, not working hard enough with others.
Thank you, Lee H. Our final question for this morning comes from Ellen.
Hi, sorry I interrupted you there, Leah. This is Ellen L. in New Jersey. Thank you so much, Janet. I recently had a sponsee who, when we started, she made it very clear that she would be completely unwilling to ever sponsor anyone ever. I proceeded to go take her through the steps because I just trusted that once she got through, she would, you know, hopefully have had a spiritual awakening and then, and if I could change, right, and her mind would have changed regarding that. But in reality, I could have said, well, you're not willing, right? We are supposed to, you know, proceed in such a way that we're willing to go to any lengths for victory, right? So you'd have to be willing to at least consider that. So I don't know, just what are your thoughts on that? If someone was very strong on something like that, would you not proceed with them or would you proceed?
Oh. Ellen, you're my good friend and throwing this hard question at me. Okay. I don't think I've ever had that, I think what I would say is probably who I met said to me when I said, I'm not willing to make an amend. She said, are you willing to trust that by the ninth step you'll be changed? And when I said, okay, she proceeded with me. So I think I would do the same thing here. I would say, okay, you're not willing now. Fair enough, right? Early on, we're selfish and we're self-centered, you know. But are you willing to believe that by the time you get to step 12, your heart will be changed and that willingness to sponsor? I think that's how I would handle it.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ellen, and thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And of course, thank you so much, Janet, for your generous service this morning and all the time and energy you gave to this presentation. We appreciate it greatly. The share ID for this morning, 23,588. That's 23588. And we will now close. From page 164, found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.